So we're going to do things a little different today. I'm only going to share for a few minutes, and then I am going to invite a handful of people up here to share some different stories, mostly serving opportunities that they've had. Last week, Charlie set up the context for this passage as well. So if you got to hear that, you got to know that this passage, just like last week's, has an eschatological theme, which is just a big word for end times. Let me briefly kind of share the gist of this parable, and then I'll invite a few people up to share some practical experiences about how really this parable plays out in our lives. So Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he's preparing them for one day when he shortly will be gone. I mean, it's Matthew chapter 25, so it's very late in Jesus' earthly ministry. So he's preparing them and saying, I'm going to be leaving soon, and I don't know when I'm going to return. Charlie talked about how even Jesus didn't know the day or the hour of when he would return. And so in the meantime, what do you do? They got to watch Jesus do his ministry to the poor and to orphans and to widows and to share love with people and tell them good news about God's kingdom of peace and justice and equality for everybody. And so he's trying to pass the torch to them and say, faithfully carry out my work while I'm gone. You don't know when I'm going to return. And Charlie talked about there's this dynamic of there's almost this feeling that even we share of this immediacy, like Jesus could come at any moment, but also this draining time where it's like it could be forever and we don't know when he's going to return. So what do we do in the meantime? We try to be as faithful as we can to his work, to carry on Jesus's heart and his ways. And it's unfortunate because a lot of us have experienced church as really this list of do's and don'ts and these requirements and these obligations, and they don't feel like an opportunity or a privilege or an honor. But I really think following Jesus should feel like a privilege. It should feel life-giving. It should feel rewarding. And it's not this obligatory, I don't think God just gives us this obligatory list of do's and don'ts that are just, he just made up, you know, to make it hard for us. But it's like everything God tells us to do in following in his footsteps is to help us help the world. And it's like he knows that by following him, that not only is the world going to be a better place, but we're going to have better lives by following him. So I felt like it's maybe good to distinguish that this parable shouldn't feel like the very last servant. I think that hopefully we're in the well done, good and faithful servant category, but it should feel like a life-giving opportunity where the master says, you know, I would entrusted you with my gifts, and you put them to good use. Well done, good and faithful servant. And so we too, I think, are entrusted with the master's things. We're entrusted with the master's heart, with the master's truth, with his image, which we talk a lot about around here, and with his mission. And I think it is an opportunity to work for his kingdom, to serve his people. And so so rather than me just talking about that and sharing from my own experience for 40 minutes, I thought, well, let's get some variety and hear some stories about people and how they're doing. You know, none of us are perfect, but they're doing their best to live out the path of Jesus and the ways of Jesus in practical ways. So would group number one please join me? So there's going to be two groups of people sharing their stories. This first group, both handfuls of people are going to be from our church. And they did an awesome job sharing this morning, by the way. But this group, I asked them to share about some of the opportunities they've had outside of our church to serve people. Because we're not too narrowly focused to think that everything has to be within our doors. But we live out in the world, and so I asked them to share. So I will grab my coffee and sit down. But David, why don't you start us off and share about an opportunity you had?
Sure. My name is David Hensold. About, it was 3 years ago, I had the opportunity to go on this year-long trip to inner-city Philadelphia with an organization called Missioneer. So Missioneer they take kind of groups of young adults, put them into teams, and house them in these inner city neighborhoods at various cities across the country. And the purpose being to kind of partner with organizations that are already active in the city. So we volunteer at various places and partner with the church there. It is a Christian organization. And then also to just be active in our neighborhoods. So it was an amazing experience for me, impactful in a lot of ways. First, I met my wife there, so that was very impactful. And then in so many other ways that when Dustin asked me to share, it was hard to pick one thing. I could talk about serving in the context of community and the community that we built together, our team there, and how important that was and still is, even though we're not together anymore. Or just kind of the vibrancy of life of the people there, even though they didn't have much and didn't have the privilege that I have. But, you know, I worked at this school, and the kids there just were awesome to be around. And even though they were kind of carrying a lot of burdens, like I said, just really living pretty vibrant lives. But the thing that I wanted to chose to focus on to kind of share with you this morning was how I felt like one of the most impactful things for me was the way that mission year kind of positioned us to receive from the poor and from our neighbors and, you know, from the people that we were there to serve. You know, I joined Mission Year because, you know, I was coming out of college, got a job at Caterpillar, was feeling like I was starting to get chained to a desk, and I was like, this is going to be the next 50 years or something? Is that? So I found Mission Year, and I just kind of dove in and wanted that opportunity to be able to serve others. But Mission Year really offered that opportunity to serve others, which is an amazing thing, right? You're going to hear all morning about ways that serving, especially, you know, kind of the most forgotten people, has amazing impact. But I think the way that we were there to receive from others provided kind of a different dynamic. So I'll share a story about a neighbor of ours named Mike. So first of all, us coming in, you know, we're five white kids coming into this mostly black neighborhood in Philly, and, you know, thinking that we're going to make a difference there. And of course, there's people who lived there a lot longer, you know, and Mike, our neighbor, was one of those. I don't think he hadn't lived there his whole life, but I think he had at least been in Philly most of his life, and lived in that neighborhood for a while, was very connected. And, you know, us coming in, we're trying to live on a really meager budget. Didn't really know how to feed ourselves on such a small amount of money. We weren't used to having to do that. So it took us months to kind of figure out the flow of, you know, where's the best place to get moderately nutritious food so we could not be hungry. And enough of it. So Mike was one that, you know, he was pretty much always sitting out on his stoop in front of his house, like most hours of the day. He wasn't very mobile, so he couldn't go many other places. He just had his 5-gallon bucket out there, sitting on it, and that's how we met him. Was we were just kind of walking through the neighborhood, trying to get acquainted, and you know, and he was very outgoing, and so we met him and kind of built a relationship. We'd just go spend some Saturdays hanging out with him, and he had some like extra canned goods that a church, you know, an area church gave to him, and he offered that to us, knowing that we were hungry. And he helped us kind of understand the neighborhood and, you know, the dynamics of it, you know, when to, like, not go out at night and things like that, you know. And he was just a good friend. He was someone who offered a lot, even though, you know, he couldn't even go down to McDonald's and get food. He asked me to do that one time. And then when I came back, he said, keep the change, which, you know, I was like, he knew full well that, you know, I didn't have to be there. You know, I chose to be there and had more privilege and opportunities than he does. But those were just small gestures in which he really wanted to give back to us. And what I found in that was really the dignity that comes with that. 'Cause, you know, us being young and not used to the city and coming in and thinking we're going to change some things, you know, can be a pretty offensive dynamic to someone who that's their everyday existence. And so being positioned in a way that he could offer things to us was really, I think, the maybe one of the best things that we could do for Mike in particular. And so that's something coming away from mission year. I'm still trying to understand how do I continue to do that. The Eric Potter's ministry, City Life, maybe you guys were here when that group came in and talked about their recent mission trip. I don't know if you caught it, but that group's existed for a while, and that was their first ever mission trip. And many of those kids, you know, grew up in church, and that was their first time to go somewhere else and offer something that they had. I think the world tries to tell us that some of us have something to offer and some of us don't. And I think that's a lie. And so that's, I think, something we can keep in mind in our service. In what ways can we serve others? In what ways can we be served by others?
Thank you for sharing, David. So, Amber, why don't you share about a group around town you've been involved with?
My name is Amber Masters, for those of you who might not know me. When I was 19, I saw a fictional film on TV called Human Trafficking, just about an undercover detective trying to bust a ring of traffickers. And I had never heard of this before and had no idea that that was actually a thing that is happening in our world today, that human trafficking affects nearly every country, including the United States, that people are still in slavery here was something I just couldn't really fathom. Shortly after that, I moved to South Korea for 2 years. I taught at an international school. I was about a mile away from a red light district, so that was across from a military base there. And just after reading some of the things, just seeing the foreign women there who didn't speak the language, it just broke my heart knowing the circumstance that they were probably in, and I felt helpless. Like, what can I do? This is a huge issue. What can I do, not being a lawyer, not being a social worker, not yet moving to Cambodia or Thailand? What can I do here? So I tried to put together a couple of events with some of my friends, and one of them was at 3030 Coffee, and some Imago Dei people came to it, and we realized we had the same passion. So we decided, well, why don't we get together and see, you know, try to brainstorm and see what can we do about this issue. So we got together and decided to meet on a regular basis about every other week. So we call ourselves the Justice League, or more formally on our Facebook page, Peorians Against Modern Day Slavery. And a couple of things that we've been trying to do. One of the first ones is prayer. I think prayer is an active way, you know, to participate in interceding for someone, whether it's praying for the victims, survivors, for the people and organizations on the front lines, as well as for the traffickers, for God to change their heart. Another one is awareness. I grew up in a Christian school and a church and never heard of human trafficking or some of these social justice issues, and I still run into a lot of people who haven't heard of it before, so trying to create a space kind of learn about that and have discussion. We recently had a documentary showing called Not My Life at the Apollo Theater where we tried to do that. Another one is raising money for people and organizations that are fighting on the front lines, having some fundraisers for that. Educating ourselves on what does it look like to put thought into the things we buy and to be a smart consumer without getting overwhelmed or breaking the bank. You know, what does that look like to make sure we're thoughtful in that? Also, pending legislation. I'm on an email chain for a couple of organizations that keep you up to date on pending legislation for trafficking and trying to keep that current. So there's days we call our legislators and representatives and urge these bills to be passed. So things like that that we try to get involved with and do. And it's a constant state of discussion. What can we do? What more can we try to do just to help with this issue? So.
Amber, I admire your determination and creativity to look for all these opportunities. What would you say if there's somebody else that maybe they have a different cause that they see an injustice in the world and they want to know, like, they kind of feel helpless like you felt, but don't know where to take some first steps?
I think there's two things for that. One would be kind of maybe Googling and doing your research, see is there an organization in my city? Is there something I can kind of jump in to be a part of? And if not, really finding people with the same passion as you. It can seem overwhelming to think of trying to tackle the idea of slavery just by yourself. But if you come together with different people with different experiences and ideas and skill sets, it can really help kind of join together for the cause and figure out what to do. So.
Cool. Keep up the good work. Kevin, your turn.
My name is Kevin McClelland. Hi, everyone. Hello, three empty rows. Hi, Kyle. Hi, Christina. I'm involved with an organization called Big Brothers Big Sisters. Anyone here heard of this organization? Yeah, a few of you have. Excellent. So for those of you who are not familiar, I'll give you a little base level introduction. Big Brothers Big Sisters is a national organization that has locally organized chapters. So here in Peoria, that is the Heart of Illinois Big Brothers Big Sisters, or for short, HOIBBBS. A lot of letters, a lot of acronyms. I got involved with this when I was I just graduated from Bradley, was still working at Bradley, and a coworker who was already involved in the organization said, hey, free pizza in the auditorium, and they tricked us. There was actually a presentation from Big Brothers Big Sisters talking about the organization, but still, food is the way to my heart, really. So, I wound up starting off and learning a lot about Big Brothers Big Sisters, and I've gotten very involved. The organization itself, here in Peoria, they don't take a lot of state funding. Pretty much everything they do is donation-based as far as funding their caseworkers who kind of work with the families and try and find matches with the volunteers and adults that serve and donate their time. They do local discounts for places like Avani's. You know, if you buy one thing, you get a kid's meal half price or something like that. So they takes a lot of time and money to organize those kind of things and even money to buy places for fundraisers or do things like that. So I'm strictly donation organization. And they do really good work in the sense that it isn't necessarily a community like activism organization. They just want families that want to have their kids be involved in something outside the classroom to keep them occupied, I guess is a good way to put it. Specifically, I'm matched with a 10-year-old boy named Joseph who lives in South Peoria. And Joseph's lived there his whole life. He just really met his father this February when his dad got out after serving an 8-year prison sentence for drug trafficking. And Joseph comes from a mixed household. His older brother is really his half-brother. They share a similar mother, but they have Corey's father is different than Joseph's father. And it's a really interesting dynamic. And he and I have been matched for about a year and a half now, and it's really, really great because it makes a very direct impact on one person, and you're not there to be another parent. You're not there to be another sibling. You're not there to be the adult to, hey, you should do this, you should do that. You're there to be a friend and to listen. And it's really nice because they try, like I said, the families, the Big Brothers Big Sisters doesn't recruit families to come do the organization. It's all volunteer recommendation based. So right now, I know there's kids on a waiting list. I think they have a waiting list 100 people deep, and I think 80% of that is males. They need a lot of males because in some of the underserved areas of Peoria, there aren't a lot of really great male role models. And for me, that's what really kind of was set the hook for me was understanding that I can be a role model with just being myself. And that's what's been really great with Joseph. He and I have found a lot of common ground on things, and he's just a really fun kid to spend time with. And I don't have to lecture him. I don't have to, that's not my job. That's not my goal. And even the caseworkers that manage the match with he and I. They say, you know, you're not there to be another parent or another voice. You're there to be a friend and to listen. And it's been a really rewarding year and a half so far. We've had a lot of fun stuff. And even when I moved to Bloomington a few months ago, I was very intentional about telling his mom and dad, I still want to be involved with Joseph's life in some capacity. And every other week or so, we meet up, go out for lunch. We both love food, like coming back to the food thing. So I try not to buy him too many lunches or dinners or anything, but as a treat, sometimes I'll go out to, you know, somewhere where he doesn't always get to eat a lot of meals out at some nicer places. So we, even going to One World was a big experience for him. So
you and Joseph have been hanging out for about a year and a half or so.
Mm-hmm.
How long did it take, I guess, for that you to feel like you're good buddies and, you know, kind of what was the process of kind of building that friendship with him?
Sure. The match and caseworker works with you guys. They would like you, when you start the match off, to meet at least twice a month or every other week until you kind of gain a really good rapport. And they really try and capture the kids before they turn into teenagers, because when you're a teenager, you're way too cool to talk to anyone who isn't also a teenager. So a lot of times they find kids between ages, you know, 6 and 12 is where they really want to start the matches up. And so with Joseph, he was a little shy at first. And once you kind of got him out of his shell, it just takes a little bit of prying and prodding. And now it's really funny. He met my girlfriend for the first time and was really quiet around her. And then not 5 minutes later, he was like flirting with her. And I said, Joseph, what are you doing? Like, stop. So for he and I to build a rapport, it took probably a few months. So we met a few times, picked him up at his house, met his mom. Big Brothers Big Sisters is good about doing a big match meeting where they have the parent or guardian there, as well as the potential match and the caseworker, and they kind of get all the baseline rules out of the way. And after that, it was just a process of, you know, Joseph, what do you like to do? And it's really, I try and let him steer whatever he wants to do. You know, we can't always go to the movies. We can't always go out to lunch or dinner, but we can always go to the park and play. We can always go drive around and look. We hung out at the zoo the other day, went to the zoo, and that was super fun. So it took about, I would say, 3 or 4 months. And Big Brothers Big Sisters provides match support for the whole length of the match. After a year, they stop calling every month after you've been matched for 12 months. So now, Joseph, I get a call probably every 2 or 3 months, kind of checking in. Hey, how are things going? Are you seeing him? Any issues that you know about at the home? Because the match workers are mandated reporters. So if there's any suspicion of anything going on in the household, abuse of any type, I'm not obligated to report it, but my caseworker is. So even if I suspect something, or if Joseph even reveals something, that's part of, I guess, an obligation of being a big, too, is saying, I'm going to look out for you and make sure you're getting the help you need, if it's needed. So,
cool. Well, thank you guys so much for sharing. Why don't we give them a round of applause, though, as they take their seats. So, something that I liked that Kevin said, that he was just being himself around him. He didn't feel, you know, at first he felt this pressure, like he's got to be this voice or this influence. But so often it's just being a friend to somebody who doesn't have friends or as many friends. And that's something that I love. I love how in each of their stories is different, that, you know, that with David, it was this year-long commitment, this intensive program where he devoted his life. It was around the clock, and that changed his life forever and set him on a different course than maybe. Maybe he's going to be at CAT 50 years, but he's going to be a different 50 years now that he did that. And with Amber being involved with an informal group that a few people formed, and it's this group of advocation and fundraising and prayer that's somewhat indirect, but also makes a big impact. And then Kevin, obviously, with making a deep impact in one kid, that there's, just like in the parable, there's, you know, one guy was given 5 bags of gold, one was given 2, and one was given 1, each according to their ability. And I just think it's good to keep in mind that God makes all of us different. Every single person is so different, and all the stories I hear are so unique, and that's why I wanted people to share, because it you know, my story is my story, but I want to help you guys form your stories. And so if there's maybe an opportunity that you heard that you wanted to connect with, go to this page on our website. We recognize that there are certain ministries that we do in our doors and in this in this community, but there's also tons of great things going on throughout the Peoria area. And so we instead of making an announcement every week about, hey, Eric Potter's doing this thing with City Life, or hey, Steven Peterson is doing this thing with United Way, we decided to make this web page. So if you go, I had to screenshot this, so I couldn't see the whole page, but across the top of our website, there are several tabs. And if you hit the Connect tab, then you'll see this list of things on the left. And right in the middle is In the Community. And so you can see four of those. One of those is the Justice League, and that's if you want to connect with Amber, her contact info's there, and Kevin's the contact for Big Brothers and Big Sisters. So there's like 8 or 9 different organizations and groups around the city that you can be involved with. So by all means, take hold of opportunities and find, you know, ask them. They're all people from our church, so some of them are on staff, some of them are just volunteers. But it's easy to just Facebook them or email them and say, hey, I've got a night a month or one day a week or whatever, and I'm interested in this. Tell me more information. So I encourage you to check that out. Well, let's have the second group come forward, if you would. And this is a group of people who I've heard their stories about ways they've served within our church body, and I guess I found it inspirational, so I was hoping that they would share with you guys as well. We'll start with Susan. Susan has been involved with the Breakfast Club, which you hear us talk about in one of our core ministries, serving opportunities, and she's also on the leadership team for that branch of our church. So, Susan, why don't you share about a memorable moment you had with the Breakfast Club?
You know I'm not going to do that.
this
well,
is a memorable
moment.
Well, I guess
it is. Okay. So what I've done...
She prepared.
Instead of me rambling, I wrote a little narrative. Oh, and I have to preface it that the voice of God is that of Tracy Ullman.
Who is that, by the way?
She's a British comedian.
Okay.
He's young. Okay. It wasn't that long ago that God surprisingly appeared out of the blue in the passenger seat of my car. Hello, what are you doing here? I kicked you out decades ago when I started my life's journey, don't you remember? I pushed you out and then sped off heading north in my Plymouth Horizon. Surely you got the memo from the church elders when they excommunicated me. You shouldn't be here. Nope, I've been here all along, right here beside you. You can continue to ignore me if you want, or we can simply ride together. I'm a great navigator, and I'll get you where you need to be. You drive. I'll ride shotgun, seeing that it's you that has the hands, the feet, and the call. So we went through rather lengthy negotiations in order to come to terms for our driving arrangements, but we finally did. And so we've been driving around together for a little while now, she and I. We spend most of our time bickering like an old married couple, but a lot of times we simply sit in silence and enjoy the scenery together. Her so-called excellent navigation skills are tough to get used to. We'll be in the middle of a conversation when she decides to whisper bizarre, cryptic messages rather than simple, straightforward directions. I think she just likes to be mysterious. The instructions have been pretty simple so far, not too challenging. Not long ago, she whispered, salt, breakfast, socks. See, it's so easy. She must think I'm stupid. So you want me to ask the salt group to bring socks to the Sunday breakfast, right? Yeah, I can do that. That's in my skill set. Great, jolly good. That will get you where you need to be. So the breakfast comes together like it always does. Starting at 6 a.m., the van drivers pick up the guest. The volunteers each bring their part of the meal. Scrambled eggs, biscuits, gravy, hash browns, sausage, milk, juice, water, fruit, and coffee. We all pitch in to serve about the 80 or so guests that attend every week. After everyone has been served, Julia and I went to the closet to distribute the small packet of toiletries that we hand out each week. But it was going to be a special week. We had socks to give to everybody. One of the guests that lined up to get their packet was a dapper, well-dressed African-American man. He was so upbeat and cheerful. "Good morning. How you doing today?" He asked if I wanted. I asked if he'd wanted socks. "Socks! You got socks? I need socks." And he pulled up his pant leg to show me his bare foot. "Girl, you made my day. Thank you, thank you. Bless you, sister." As he walked away, I thought for the briefest moment, there goes Jesus. I turned my attention back to the line, to the next guest. He was disheveled, unkempt. He was a dirty man. He kept his head down. I had never seen him before, but I immediately recognized his shame, his pain, his addiction, his regrets. I asked him if he wanted a pair of socks. He barely nodded. When I handed him the socks, he looked up just for a split second, and I saw his eyes. There was no doubt. He was Jesus. No fear, no judgment, no guilt. All of that fell away. All I saw was his divinity. All I saw was love. He then mumbled something that might have been thanks as he walked away. Not long ago, this past Wednesday, as a matter of fact, I was recalling this story with God. I told her how thankful I was that Jesus had been revealed to me by simply following her crypt sock instructions. I told her it was time for me to share the divine sock story with others, with you. She smiled a curious smile as if she knew something I didn't. "What? What am I missing? What are you not telling me?" "Susan, you seeing Jesus was just a small part of the story. It's kind of like John 3:16. That's a small part of the story. It's true, but it doesn't do justice to the bigger picture. It's not nearly complete. Although you can never, ever comprehend this, I'll tell you the truth. Here is what really happened. Susan, I planned that encounter since the beginning of time. 14.5 billion years ago, wink, wink, I unleashed 117 elements, nudge, nudge, into the cosmos to evolve into the universe, into all that you know, into your world. I created life so that you could come into being. I set you on your decades-long hero's journey with all of its forays into hell so that you could be exactly where you needed to be to hand over those socks so that he could look into your eyes and see Jesus. I am navigating to get you where you need to be. I am constantly recalculating your route so that you end up in a place where you are able to see Jesus in others all the time, and where others can see Jesus in you. For those of you who pray, for those of you who read scripture, and you have your puzzle pieces neatly connected, I'm sure this scene, Jesus' mission, is nothing new to you. But for me, someone who bickers with God, someone who spent years mocking Jesus, and who spends years struggling just to turn my puzzle pieces right side up, this development is blindsiding. Truth be told, I just see myself as a relatively privileged woman who is simply making a modicum of effort to help my community in order to ease my conscience. The thought of me actually projecting Jesus terrifies me. God knows my fears. "Don't worry. Just relax. Pull the car over for a bit and breathe. It's okay. Just don't stop pretending that I don't exist again. Whenever you're ready to start driving, we can go. Take your time. I'm not going anywhere." Then she leans over. "Blog. Imago. Share."
That was beautiful, Susan. Thank you for sharing. All right, Jamie, you get to follow that.
Yeah. With a British accent.
Yeah, no. Seriously.
No.
You could be. You could really narrate audiobooks. Maybe you should write a book. Have you thought of that? I'm serious. Have you? Jolly good. Okay. Well, we'll talk about that later.
All right. I'm Jamie, and probably about 2 years ago, I started serving at the Breakfast Club, and soon after that, had met Eric the intern. I don't know many of you know him, and he asked me if I wanted to be a part of the leadership team with the Breakfast, and soon after that, Eric calls me late at night one night and says that he has this friend that had been coming to the Breakfast that needed a ride from the hospital to where she was staying at a shelter. And so I didn't know this woman. It was late at night, but I said, okay. And that was 2 years ago, and it just was the start of this beautiful friendship with a woman that's the same age as my mom. I don't know. It started off. There was a group of us that kind of came alongside her to help her out in practical ways, to help her with rides, to doctor's appointments, to help her get her laundry done, or just this and that, and it started that way. And you know, we all kind of came in it as we want to intentionally help this woman out. And the word intentional really started to make me nervous, because I was afraid that I would start to be intentional with this woman, but it would be fake and it wouldn't be real and genuine. It would just be me trying to be a friend to her and trying to do good things because that's what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, but that's so not what happened. I really fell in love with this woman for who she was and the gifts that she had. And in this 2-year journey, I've been able to come alongside her and help her attempt to get her GED, which she ended up not wanting to get. But and then it started to be where let's not practice studying for this test. Let's just go to a coffee shop and talk. And then it was, oh, I know about this really cool thrift store. Let's just go and hang out. And, you know, it started to become these phone calls of just wanting to get to know each other. I've been able to watch this woman through her ups and downs, as well as she has seen me go through my ups and downs. She now has her own place where before she was living in a shelter, and she has a job, but she struggles with drug addictions, and I've been able to hold her hand as we're in a methadone clinic and cry in her home alongside other people in our church and just pray over her that she can find ways to fight her addiction. And I just think that's what friendship is about. It's about coming alongside each other. Yes, being intentional, but also just being there for them no matter what.
Is there anything else? Thank you for sharing. I love that we see such value in just getting to know people And it's amazing the beauty that can happen out of a relationship like that. Corey?
All right, sorry, you have to listen to my monotone voice now. So I'm Corey Brown. I'm on the mission team, I guess, or whatever. Our church has been sending teams to Honduras for 6 or 7 years. I've been going myself for 4 years and want to share about that a little bit. So the most common question I get after coming back from a trip is, so how was your trip? Was it a good trip? And that is probably the most difficult question there is to answer, because there's so much about these trips that is just good. We usually have a lot of fun on the trips. We're always joking. It's just a good time that we have with all four teams that I've been on. I've had lots of fun with the people, getting to know people. It's been great. It's a cultural experience that was exciting for me to get outside of the U.S. and to see some of what's going on in the rest of the world. I really enjoy that. The food there is phenomenal. It's like nothing you've ever had here, in a good way. And then, you know, the natural beauty of the landscape, everything's awesome. But there's a whole other aspect of the trip where, yes, it's good and it's right that our team is there interacting with it, but the situation, there's nothing about it that is good. It is anything but that. There's an entire system that is completely broken that leaves all these people marginalized with no support system whatsoever. It's a type of poverty that I don't think even really exists in the United States. There are certainly pockets of it in the U.S., but there's absolutely no support system for these families. And so I guess I've shared this story a few years ago in the church, but the first trip I went down there, I was sitting on the ground, and this girl came up to me and sat next to me, and over the course of the week, we developed a friendship. She was 7 years old. Her name's Sarah E. And I'd try to talk to her, and I knew very little Spanish at the time. And we'd have little conversations or whatever, but I didn't understand anything she was saying. She didn't know what questions I was asking. And then whenever I'd get a translator to come over, she didn't like the translator. She liked talking to me, so she wouldn't really say anything. And so I probably misunderstood most of what she said. But one day, we were pouring cement floor for the house that we were working on, and I learned the word cemento. Very complicated. And I was trying to figure out where she lived, if she lived in a house that Mercy International had built, or if she lived in one of the shacks around. And so I'm like, cemento en su casa. And she's like, no, and she realizes she has no way to communicate with me what's going on, and she gets this bright idea, and she reaches down, grabs a handful of dirt, picks it up, and, you know, there's a little piece of dirt falling through her fingers, and she looks up at me, and she's got this huge grin on her face. She's so excited that she figured out how to tell me that she lives in a shack with a dirt floor by holding up a handful of dirt. It's just so striking how excited she was about it. So I guess at the end of that trip, having experienced people living in poverty like that and talking to them and developing relationships, she's like, after my first trip, I think I felt mostly broken and not a lot of hope for the situation. But it's totally transformational in my own life and how I view that situation, because before that it was, you know, I knew that people lived in houses like that. I knew that there was poverty and that people were struggling, but it was just like statistics and theoretical problems. Now I have real people with names that are friends of mine that are living in that house. And And then to see how, over time, how through the work of our church and the relationships that we built there, and also through just the ministry that Mercy International is doing that we get to help them with, to see over the years how that community is transforming, and that we can not just provide houses and concrete floors for people, but that there's a sense of hope that is beginning to build. For Sarah E., I really believe, I think she got a concrete floor last summer, and that's great. I'm super excited about her new house. But I don't believe that that's ultimately what she needs in life. What she needs is a support system that will tell her that she is valuable, that she is important, that she matters to people. And that's exactly what we get to do for a short period of time when we go down there, is just sit by her, like, let her know that she is important to me. And so I think that going to Honduras has been incredibly transformational in how I view the gospel and how I understand what God is doing in the world and how I understand other people around me. And it's a transformation. I think I could have sat in service, listened to great teaching, and read the Bible lots and lots of times, and I would have missed it forever. But just for me, being there, interacting, it was incredibly powerful.
Thank you for sharing. I love hearing your guys' stories and hearing your hearts. I appreciate you sharing. So thank you, guys. Can we give them a hand, too? So just like the disciples that Jesus was talking about in the parable, we have been entrusted with the Master's things. We all have something to contribute. He's entrusted us with his image, his truth, his heart for people, his mission. And don't ever think for a second you don't have something you can give. And one of the things I love most about our church is that so many of you already have, or you've already caught onto this, and you don't even realize it, or some of you do realize it, but basically every person I asked was like, I don't know if I really have anything to share. And obviously you can tell they do. They're just humble. So for so many of us that have had opportunities to serve or that are giving in meaningful ways, maybe today is just an opportunity for you to be reminded of the impact you're making and the importance of what you're doing, of creating beauty or spreading love or listening to people, being a friend to somebody. I mean, what was Jesus if he wasn't a friend? And so it's just leaning in to that thing a little bit more. Or maybe today you heard something and it's an idea sparked of an idea that you might try something new or try something different. Maybe you're in a season where you have a little bit more to give or you want to give a little differently. So I wanted to read a prayer, but the song that the band played earlier really caught me today. And so I thought I would end with just singing that prayer of St. Francis, a line in that really stuck out to me today. Goes a little something like this. May your love cause us to open up, cause us to open up our hearts. May your light cause us to shine so bright that we bring hope into the dark. Amen.